the diaspora. My book is a book from somebody in the diaspora. I didn't grow up on the continent.
Right.
And to an extent, it reflects my diaspora, you know, upbringing. It's one of the reasons why I chose fantasy, because then I can still have a space, you know, a space to invent. Yeah.
Well, this question might be a premature question, but you said that you've once considered yourself a Victorian novelist,
mm-hmm.
and that A Brief History of Seven Killings was your loosest and riskiest novel,
mm-hmm.
and that winning the Booker Prize sort of affirmed for you that writing in a less constrained way, in a way that felt more like you, was working.
Mm-hmm.
So if A.S. Byatt is right that each novel teaches you how to write the next one,
mm-hmm.
what can we expect next from you post-trilogy?
She's absolutely right. Absolutely right. I remember reading that and I was like, oh my God, it's so true. Each novel I've written has taught me how to write one before. My first novel was the first novel where I thought I can trust a novel to the voice of the people. So it wrote the second novel came with all in patois. But that's still a very classic idea of a novel, which is why I think a lot of people, that tends to be their favorite. It's a very classic idea of a novel. It's a Victorian novel. In fact, it's like a Jane. It's a Victorian novel. That's a novel that taught me that I can actually totally break with everything I think a novel should be.
Hmm.
And write the novel that's in your head. Brief History taught me a lot of things. One, how to write about queerness with a very matter-of-fact, almost cavalier attitude, where even if I, as a person, I'm still getting used to walking in those shoes, my characters are way beyond it. Brief History taught me to remember that my characters are already functioning in a world, even if it's new to me. It's new to me. I'm just writing it. But it's hard for me. I've never had to pay attention to it before, that even though I am new to the novel as a writer, my characters are living in those worlds for years. If, you know, Sutherland is 313 years old. I've been writing the book 2 years. She's been in it for 313.
Right.
So the Brief History taught me to remember how my characters should move in a book. Nearly everybody in that world, I am the newest person to the world. So I have to write it like a journalist who just jumped onto the story. And so, she's absolutely right. I can see in very clear ways how each novel prepared me for the following one.
Do you know what your next project is?
Well, the next project is a sequel, and it's told by Sagalan. And for those people who've read it, and if you're going to read it, you'll realize that if she's the person telling the next story, this is going to be some radically different.
It really is.
I've been warning readers. I'm like, you may have developed some emotional attachments to the first book. You might want to reconsider those.
Well, it was great having you on the show today, Marlon.
This was great. Thank you.
We're talking today to Marlon James, the author of Black Leopard, Red Wolf. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Building Bridges to Sustainability on Friday, March 8th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at PCC Cascade Campus in Portland. Building Bridges to Sustainability features keynote speakers, presentations, and breakout sessions where participants will have opportunities to gain insights to equity, economic opportunity, and social justice while shaping a culture of sustainability. Again, that's Building Bridges to Sustainability, Friday, March 8th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus, 705 Northeast Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
One day, I decided to organize Mama's number running materials and went through the house gathering everything together into one shallow cardboard box. I was enamored of my own organizational skills and decided to add one final touch. On the side of the box, using bright pink nail polish, I carefully painted in boxy letters, Mama's Numbers. I proudly showed this to my mother, impressed with myself for remembering the possessive apostrophe. She took one look and said, "You can't put my business out in the street like that." Looking back, this was the moment when I became consciously aware that I must keep my admiration for my mother's work a private. Before, I had known to keep her livelihood a secret, but hadn't yet formed an opinion of, felt any pride in, what Mama actually did for a living. Now, I understood that my pride for her also had to be kept secret, as did the evidence of her work. Chastened, I took my black magic marker and scratched out what I had painted onto the box. And after that episode, I began shoving things into drawers away from visitors' view. Yet, to my delight, Mama continued to keep all her paraphernalia in that box, which ended up permanently perched atop a Louis XV style chair in her bedroom. If I looked closely, I could still see the pink letters I had painted beneath the blackout marker. And whenever I passed by, I would chant to myself, incantation style, Mama's Numbers, Mama's Numbers, Mama's Numbers.
Good morning, and welcome to Black Book Talk for March. This is Emma Jackson Ford here with
Patricia Hill Welch
and O.B. Hill.
You are just listening to our wonderful guest for this month, Bridgette M. Davis, the author of The World According to Fannie Davis. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know, in that quote, it seems like you've summed up really the parameters of your life, you know, in growing up, that you had a wonderful mother and a wonderful story to tell, but you could tell us. So could you tell our listeners a little bit more about what your mother did and why you could not talk about Mama's Numbers or Mama's life?
Yes. So from my earliest memory, my mother had a business that she operated out of our home. She was essentially what we call a numbers runner. And more specifically, she was a banker for the numbers, which meant that she was running this underground lottery system that many black people knew about and called the numbers. So people actually literally gave their bets to her and tried to win, tried to hit. And if they didn't, they owed her money. And if they did hit, she would pay their winnings to them. And so that was an incredible experience to watch growing up, except for the fact that the numbers were illegal. And so we couldn't tell anyone what our mother did for a living.
My family is very excited about this book. I was telling them about The World According to Fannie Davis, and they were likening it to that in Portland, marijuana has been legalized. So the government is making millions of dollars off the selling of marijuana, something that black people we knew have been put in jail for. But now it's legalized and a million maker.
Because the numbers were created by one man in Harlem in the 1920s. And so for nearly 60 years, this was a black-created and largely black-owned operation that moved across many cities throughout the U.S. And it was legislated. It was, you know, considered criminal behavior, and people did go to jail. And yet, by the 1970s in Detroit and other cities, the states stepped in and decided to make it legal. Suddenly, lotteries are legal. And that thing that had been criminalized got taken over and usurped by the government. That sounds familiar, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Very familiar. What is the relationship between this and off-track betting?
It's interesting. In New York, there was a connection because when the legal lottery started really sort of becoming a possibility, the idea was off-track betting, the people who ran that would come in and provide that form of gambling, and the idea was, and the hope was, that it would get rid of this sort of underground lot, this underground numbers business. And so it was almost as though the state of New York was making a deal with these OTP people, you know, off-track betting folks, and saying, okay, you bring yours in, and we'll get rid of that other one that the black folks are running, and all's good. And so it was very odd to me, because growing up in Detroit, there was not this competition from OTB.
I'm curious about something else. I absolutely remember growing up with the numbers, remember playing the numbers, had close family and friends, you know, who were involved. But I don't remember any women. I just don't. Maybe I missed it. But I don't remember very many women being involved in terms of being runners or bankers. Was that unusual? And how did your mother even, you know, end up doing that?
Yeah, you are absolutely correct. The reason you don't remember is that there really weren't any women involved at that level. And I knew my mother was unique. I knew I had friends whose mothers were very different from her. But it was only recently, when I began to research the book, that a scholar came to me and said she was doing a dissertation on the numbers in Detroit, and could she please interview me about my mother? It was so important to her. And I said to her, why? I mean, yes, I'll do it, but why is it so important? And she said, don't you know? And I said, no, what? She said, your mother was the only woman at that level. Okay. Eventually, another woman became involved in the numbers, too, and my mom and she were friends, but in those early years, in the 60s and 70s, she was the one.
Did you all understand that?
No.
At all.
We knew that our mom was probably a feminist without anyone using that word.
Mm-hmm.
But we understood that she believed in self-determination and that she was in charge. Our father, and later our stepfather, they were not in charge. Our mother was. And so it's not a stretch for me to imagine that it did not occur to her that because she was a woman, she couldn't do it. I don't think it ever occurred to her.
How long did it take for you to do the research and just write this book?
Well, I tell people it really was a 10-year odyssey, because it was literally 10 years ago when my son, who was 9 years old at the time, looked at a photograph of my mom that I kept on a side table, and he said to me, Mom, what was she like? And my heart sank. I said to him, oh, she was amazing, but I was really breaking inside, because I realized that I had done such a great job of keeping her secret that I had kept her a secret from my own children. And I thought at that moment, okay, this cannot continue. I cannot let that be what is the ultimate reality for my own children. They need to know their grandmother. And that began the process for me of going back to Detroit on several trips to interview my mom's siblings, our family friends, relatives, her friends, everyone I could think of, which ended up being about 24 people, to talk about Fanny. And I didn't rush it. I let myself do that across several years. And then, you know, I began to do the research that really fills up the social context of the book. And the writing itself was really only about a year.
This sort of reminds me of Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad.
Oh, that's impressive.
Well, it seems to me that when people are trying to make a living and being denied the opportunity to have the equal access to the financial structure, then they have to be creative and do something else in order to be free.
Very true, very true. My mom always said, you know, her attitude was that what she was doing, the numbers, was a legitimate business that just happened to be illegal.
I want to know a little bit more about your mother. I mean, what was her background that would have led her to be so bold as to say, I'm going to do this? I mean, surely she knew that, you know, this was something that very few, even if she didn't know she was the only one, she had to know very few women did this. So what gave her the heart to say, this is what I'm going to do?
I am speculating that my mom learned a lot from her own father. She was a native of Nashville, as was my own father. So both of them were, you know, Nashville migrants who came to Detroit together with my three oldest siblings. But when she grew up in Nashville, she was the ninth of 10 children, and her father was an entrepreneur. He had his own plastering business. And imagine a black man in the South in the early years of the 20th century having his own business. And she grew up witnessing him as a successful man. And I know that that influenced her understanding of what's possible and the belief that you shouldn't accept less, that you should be allowed to chase that American dream, and if it's through an entrepreneurial means, why not? You know? And I'm pretty certain that her choices were influenced by him as her model.
And I am further wondering about your grandmother raising nine children. What was she like?
My grandmother was named Caroline, and everyone called her Kine, which was short for Caroline, but also a perfect description of her. She was so loving and gentle. But she also used to help her husband with his business. She took care of the books.
Okay.
Yeah, so they were really a team.
And
yeah, and so that's something else that my mother witnessed.
I was going to say, your family has a background in numbers.
When you think about it, they do, because she had the ledger, you know. And you see, my grandfather depended on her to keep those records and to let him know, you know, what he owed to whom, and because he had men employed under him that worked for him. So he was, you know, to run that business, he really did depend on his wife to help keep the record straight.
In a nutshell, could you tell us how many numbers are there?
I don't know exactly. I know that the odds for being able to win a three-digit number, to sort of guess that combination, are 1,000 to 1.
Hmm.
And there are myriad different ways that a number can come out, and so you could imagine how challenging it is to actually come up with the right combination. And yet people did, you know? We all, those of us who know about the numbers and have memories of it in our midst, we all know about folks who would hit the number.
Yes, that's what kept keep people playing. I remember a woman that I've worked with. She had a dream book. I did and do tend to lose keys. And she was like, you need to be playing the number for your keys, Patricia. I can't even remember what it was. But the thing is, we all knew somebody that hit. So the numbers were very, very much a part of the economy, the day-to-day economy of the black community. And many people, but for the numbers, wouldn't have been able to do things, send their kids to school, buy a house or whatever. So, I mean, it was a part of the foundation of the community. I was impressed that your mother, while she had to be discreet, but she very clearly enjoyed the benefits of her success. She made sure that you and your family had a certain lifestyle. Now, I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, my mom's belief was that you should live well and you should be generous. Those were her sort of edicts about life. She took to heart this belief that all Americans had a right to the pursuit of happiness. And she considered herself an American who had earned that right and whose family had earned it and whose ancestors had earned it. And so she thought her attitude was no guilt around pursuing that happiness. And don't fool yourself. Money is a part of it. Money is necessary to be able to live in a way that allows you to pursue happiness. She was not obsessed with money, however. She never tried to get so big in the business that she put her family at higher risk. For her, it was about a brisk and robust lifestyle that gave her children some privileges and some opportunity. That was her goal. And she believed that the more you give, the more you receive. She really believed it. And what was great was to hear so many people I interviewed talk about her generosity. It was really something. I would be interviewing a friend, and she'd say, oh, yeah, there was that time your mom sent me $500. I'm like, what? I mean, I was learning so much for the first time because she never talked about all of the things that she did for people. But I want to connect the two. I want people to understand that there was no guilt for her around living well, and she believed that with that you help others. You help others. That's what it's about. She loved to see people, black folks, doing well. And if she could help you, if she could give you that little financial push to set you out on your way, all the better.
I heard your interview on NPR, and you were mentioning the dream book. I am fascinated by the idea of the dream book. Could you say a little bit of something about that?
Oh, dream books are incredible. I remember as a child just reading them, not for the reason that numbers players did. I liked them as books, and I thought that they were filled with all of this magical advice. But then as I did research, I learned that dream books have been around since the 19th century. And there are a plethora of them. All kinds of people publish these dream books. And what they are essentially are these encyclopedic reference guides for people to look up the three-digit equivalent of anything, mm-hmm. and I do mean anything, that they could dream about. You know? So any person, place, thing, anyone's name, if any experience, if you saw a black cat, oh, look it up in the dream book. It plays for something.
<neat. laughs>
And so those books really allowed folks to figure out just what to play on a given day, but they also were the centerpiece of a kind of social engagement. Folks would show up at my mom's home to play their numbers, and they would really want to just talk to her about what they had dreamed. And, hey, Fanny, go get the Red Devil dream book and look up this for me. Tell me what Black Hat plays for. Mm-hmm. And that became a conversation, you know. And so those books represent a lot. You know, they have a lot of sort of significance, like, held within them. It's really something to go through one of them and just see all of the things that are listed.
So amazing, a whole nother world.
Another world, yeah.
As a banker, how many people fed into her books?
Well, I'd like to say, to give people a reference, there was a huge numbers man in Detroit back in the day called Eddie Wingate. And just to tell you how big he was, by the 60s, he was already a millionaire, which meant that many, many bookies were turning their numbers into him as a banker. And he was so large that at one point he launched a record company that rivaled Motown. And the smartest thing Berry Gordy did was buy him out for $1 million.
Whoa.
Back in the day. That was a lot of money.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Eddie Wingate was extremely successful and large. My mother was nowhere near that size. You know, if you think about an organizational structure, he's the CEO at the top, and she's a really sort of like efficient manager in that structure. So in her case, she might have had at her height 9 or 10 books. Well, what are books? A book is comprised of all the people who turn their bets into one person. So even though she might have had about 10 books, each of those books could contain within them bets from another dozen people. And so that's why she had this volume that enabled her to have a really wonderful middle, sometimes upper middle, sometimes a little lower middle class life. It would fluctuate. But it was consistent enough to give us that, what I called a blue-collar black bourgeoisie life.
You know, you touched on something when you mentioned Eddie Wingate. Talk about the place of the numbers, kings and queens, in their various communities, because what, again, a lot of people don't know is that these people made really some very significant contributions to the well-being of the black community wherever they are. So could you just give one or two examples, talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, people don't know this. Wingate was a businessman, and so he launched a lot of businesses. That benefited him, but also it provided services. One of my older siblings' favorite place to go was a place called the 20 Grand Nightclub.
Oh, yeah.
I only recently learned that Eddie Wingate owned that club. Well, that was a place where black folks could go and hang out. It was nice. It was in a decent neighborhood.
As a former Detroiter, yes, the 20 Grand was very, very nice. So I am absolutely, you know, verifying what you're saying. Yes.
Yes.
I had no idea.
That was a service that was provided. Years before that, in the 40s, a man named John White bought the Hotel Gotham.
Yes.
And turned it into a place where all of these black celebrities, entertainers, dignitaries, politicians, athletes could come to Detroit and stay in a beautiful hotel.
Yes.
Well, that's nice, but it's also necessary because people don't know this. Back in the day, if you were black, you couldn't go to a downtown white hotel mm-hmm. and book
right.
a room. You couldn't stay there. So these numbers men were filling in the void with this informal economy that the formal economy had basically kept black folks from being part of.
Yes.
So these were real services that were being provided for the community, not to mention money for scholarships, you know, or another of my favorite stories. The NAACP and the National Urban League were fledgling back in the day. In those 50s, early 60s, they were struggling. Numbers men kept those businesses, kept those organizations afloat. And that became vital. In fact, John White wouldn't let anyone work in his hotel unless they were registered to vote and they were members of the NAACP contributing to the organization. You see, numbers men were race men. And they understood that that was their role, to take that largesse and give back. And thank goodness they did, because Detroit really was a hotbed of the civil rights movement, right?
Absolutely.
Those organizations became vital. Detroit had the biggest chapter of the NAACP for many years. So look how that affects our history. Look how that affects the civil rights movement. Look at Joe Lewis. I didn't know this until I was really researching the book, that his manager was a man named John Roxborough, who brought the numbers to Detroit from Harlem and decided that he wanted to create a black hero. So he took all that money he made in the numbers and he invested in Joe Lewis.
See, there is so much history, you know, so much knowledge that has been kept from us that is in your book. Your mother was obviously an incredible businesswoman and just an incredible human being. But the broader story of what she and others in her business did for their communities is one we need to hear. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of the time that's allotted for this program. Oh. But I want to ask, I do want to say quickly one thing. You're going to be in town at the end of this month for a conference. The Association of Writers and Writing Professionals or something. Is any portion of that open to the public, or is it just for people who have registered? Because I would love for people to be able to see you and talk to you about this.
I really wish it was open to the public. You could, people can buy a day pass, and they can go to many of the events, including my panel. I'll be on two panels, both on that Friday and that Saturday. But it is a writer's conference, and so it does require that you basically register for the event.
Okay. Tell us the name of the conference again officially, because I want people to listen and Google it. Incredible numbers of writers are going to be coming. So.
Yes. It attracts as many as 15,000 people, and a lot of major writers are there. And it's just the quickest way to refer to it is the AWP conference.
And I think that's probably enough. Yeah, they can go and do that.
If you look that up, definitely people will find out. I mean, you'll see Portland will be taken over by writers for a few days.
Oh, well, we love that. Bridgette Davis, thank you for introducing us to your mother. Thank you for joining us on the show. And we hope to invite you back again so you can tell us about your other books. But for today, this is the end of the March edition of Black Book Talk. Good reading to you.
Oh, great speaking with you guys. Thank you so much.
You are more than welcome. Bye-bye.
See you next month.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling